This is your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel, serving the Charlottesville area with home heating oil and propane and famous Exxon gasolines. The wake-up call is also brought to you by The Hook, an innovative weekly from the people who really know the news on Newsstands Thursday. Now with your host, Rick Moore.
All right, everybody can listen today. We don't want to turn anybody away, but those with pets or considering pets, which do make interesting holiday presents with the right frame of mind. Dr. Mike Feetz here from Georgetown Veterinary Clinic. Mike?
Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for coming in.
No problem.
How was your holiday?
Good, good.
Did you eat too much?
Yes, much too much. I'm likewise recovering from my coma.
Did you work on Friday?
Yes.
So did I.
Yeah.
The holiday was all too short. But again, we're going to take calls about questions, sort of free questions about pet needs. Dial us up, 979-0919, 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS. Tim Davis out there today answering the phones and patching you through. If you don't want to come on air, just give Tim your question. We'll do it that way. Mike Feetz, special guest today because Mike was the vet when Zephyr got shot.
Mm-hmm.
Quite a traumatic time that the bedside manner and the quality work paid off. And for those who are still concerned, I get this question a lot. Zephyr's still missing. The border collie, black is the number one color, some white right down the nose, and a little pink dot right at the end. Sarah would love to have Zephyr back if anyone ever sees or finds him. All right, let's get started. I got plenty of questions on my list. Would love to have some calls. Call in with your questions as well. It is a nice, beautiful, sunny Sunday. So we'll take your cell phone call if needed. WNRN Studio is the AOL instant message line for questions. 979-0919. 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS is the toll-free number. Mike, I saw you just last week, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I brought Lazarus in. He was having some, he was scratching his ear a lot. But don't dogs scratch their ear fairly regularly? I mean, it's not unusual for a dog to kind of stop and scratch an itchy spot.
No, I mean, just like it's not unusual for us to scratch an occasional itch. I think it's just a matter of trend. If he's doing it too much, then you might worry he's got an infection or an allergy or something.
But we were talking about how some dogs, especially mine, are very mellow and low-key and really don't alert you to the fact that there might be a problem.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's one of the tricks in veterinary medicine and you know, people comment on it pretty often is that they can't come in and tell you exactly what's wrong. You know, you're kind of relying on your own and the owner's intuition about what might be going on. But people know their dogs pretty well. Usually they can tell if something's wrong, even if they can't tell exactly what. But yeah, you're right. Some dogs are very mellow and stoic, and they just don't advertise if they're in pain or discomfort at all. They just kind of smile and wag through it. Yeah.
So how do you, as a vet, how do you determine this? I mean, you have it's all magic.
Yeah.
You have little or minimal input from the owner. My dog, as wonderful as he is, and as many long-distance calls I find when I'm away at work, he doesn't talk to me or you that much.
Yeah. I think people would be surprised. We get a lot of input from owners, and I think, you know, people's observations at home are important. A lot of people come in and worry that, you know, they're overreacting or seeing things that aren't there. And to some extent, you need to filter through what's real and what might not be, or, you know, is the owner alerted and over-focusing on something. But the history that comes from people is a huge part of working up these cases, and it's a lot of the information I use in trying to think what's going on. And otherwise, yeah, sometimes you're looking for very subtle things. Some symptoms are very vague and nonspecific and really leave you wondering what could be going on. It leaves you with a huge pile of possibilities in some cases, yeah.
But I don't have pet insurance, and we'll get into that in a minute. And prescriptions are not inexpensive.
No, not always. Yeah.
So, you know, what do you do? I don't mean this in any sort of negative manner, but only have so much time with each pet.
Sure, you only so much time. I mean, there's resources in both directions. And like you said, you know, in a more time-consuming case, we'll generally have the animal stay if we need to do other things. I mean, we find time if the animal needs the time. I don't think there's any question about things like that. And, you know, you touched on medication. Obviously, case to case, different people have different resources. And you just learn as a clinician to work within those boundaries and, you know, do what you need to for that animal within whatever, you know, limitations that case might have.
Can I give my dog aspirin?
Aspirin.
Or your cat? Can you get, and again, because I have a dog and not a cat, I don't want to focus too much on one type.
And I'm glad you drew the distinction because it's actually important. Cats, no, absolutely no. The way they process that drug, and any drug in that class for matter, aspirin, Tylenol, can be very dangerous to them. So with cats, it's an absolute no. With dogs, they can safely take aspirin, but I don't recommend giving it to your dog unless you've spoken with a vet first. The dosing can be a little bit strange. They are more prone to the stomach side effects that we already deal with, but they deal with worse. In a lot of cases, there are other similar drugs that can be used for dogs that can be used in much lower dose safely and more effectively in most cases. So it's not a simple yes or no answer. But I do see dogs frequently. I mean, one of the number one poisonings I see is dogs that get into entire bottles of similar drugs like ibuprofen and that sort of thing, which can be dangerous in higher doses. So, yeah.
And again, I'll say this a few times throughout the hour, but you need to see your vet. It's specific questions for your specific pet. don't decide that, Dr. Pete said that dogs can process aspirin here, take two. It says take two every 4 hours.
Yeah, and I hope that the take home was no, don't give your dog aspirin unless a veterinarian tells you it's a good idea.
It's a beautiful Sunday. Some people may only be paying partial attention, but you can always go back to the podcast, www.cvillepodcast.com, if for some reason you need to leave early or you join in late. Dr. Mike Feetz, who is a veterinary doctor at the Georgetown Veterinary Clinic here in Charlottesville, here for the hour. Dial us up, 979-0919. 1-877-WNRN rocks. I got our first question. I believe this will be a familiar voice to both of us. It's Sarah from Levinson. Hey, Sarah.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well.
Here's my question, and I was watching a TV show the other day, and the owner of the dog was crying because he didn't want to get his male dog neutered. He thought he was doing something to his dog's psychology.
Yeah.
So I was just wondering, Dr. Feetz, if you could address what really happens when you neuter a dog and why it's important and if that dog was indeed going to be okay mentally afterwards.
Yeah,
I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
That's okay. I mean, it'll definitely be okay mentally after. I mean, dogs have really no idea of what happened afterwards, and most of them are back to fairly normal by the next day. Neutering is what it is. I mean, it's a castration. They you know, that's why men are upset by it. That's kind of projecting. I see this a lot, you know, male owners that are reluctant to do it because they're kind of internalizing what's going to happen. It is important. It does serve a preventative function. There are certain medical problems, things like prostate enlargement, that dogs are less prone to later on. Certainly, especially dogs that are prone to any kind of aggression or roaming or things like that. Those can be minimized by neutering, especially at an earlier age. Possibly the number one reason is just for pet population reasons. It's just an obscene number of animals out there, and anything that we can do to prevent new ones from entering the pool. Every new dog that's born is another animal that stays in the shelter because it doesn't get adopted. So we do kind of like everyone to do their part in trying to minimize that.
But yeah. Why mm-hmm. is it such a big deal? I mean, it can't be... the large number of excess pets that are out there because people don't spay or neuter can't strictly be because the males going, oh, I don't want that to happen to my dog.
Oh, no, it's not. I mean, I mean,
is it laziness? Is it misunderstanding?
I think it's largely misunderstanding and like I said, fear. I think some people really don't like the idea of their male dog being neutered. I mean, I have very few people, unless they plan on breeding their female dogs, reluctant to spay their female dogs. This is obviously a lesser concern for women than it is for men. So obviously there's a psychological component here. I very frequently have dogs come in where the reluctance is specifically in neutering them.
Mike Feetz here from the Georgetown Veterinary Clinic. Ask the vet about your pet. For the hour, dial up 979-0919, online, WNRN Studio at the AOL Instant Message Key. Mike, what's the difference between DMV and VDM? And I'm not talking about the where to get my license.
And those are both similar in that neither one is a veterinary degree. DVM is the usual veterinary degree. VMD is a it's the same degree, just comes from University of Pennsylvania. Their diplomas are in Latin, so the initials are different. But functionally, it's the same thing, yeah.
But you said neither one is a veterinary degree?
Yeah, I think you said DMV first, oh. Which is the Department of Motor Vehicles.
Oh. Yeah. And that's, you know, that's standard. That's we'll call that mistake number one for the hour and see
it's
if
all,
I can keep,
it, good.
See if I can keep it in the single digits.
We can run a tally between the two of us and see who gets more wrong.
I'm going to run out of fingers and toes. Do you make house calls?
We do not, and or at least not typically. There are veterinarians in the area that do. Yeah, and actually, we work with some of them. So a lot of times, you know, things that need a hospital setting will come to us after seeing a house call vet elsewhere. So we all kind of work together.
All right. Here's a question from online: is I know my dog can't eat grapes. Don't know why. What other foods can't they eat?
Yeah, grapes, you know, most people know that dogs shouldn't eat chocolate. That's kind of one of those standard don't feed to your dog things. Grapes and raisins are a newer thing on the list. It's poorly understood. The reason they're toxic in dogs is not well understood right now. And it is thought to be dose dependent. So if your dog snags a raisin or a grape off the floor, it's not an emergency. But as they eat more of them, the potential for kidney toxicity starts to build and can actually be a fairly terrible toxicity. Some of those cases are extremely difficult to manage.
What is it about a grape that does that?
It's unknown. To my knowledge, no one's figured out what's toxic in a grape or raisin yet to specifically dogs. I mean, obviously, they don't affect us at all. It's a shame, too, because it's not something people expect to be toxic. So when the dog gets into the can of raisins, most people don't presume to call the vet right away because it seems, you know, what's the worst that's going to happen? The dog will get some diarrhea or something. But in reality, it can be very toxic for them. Otherwise, you know, as far as the list of things dogs can't eat, you know, by and large, if we can eat it, they can. But there's weird exceptions like that. Other you know, common things like onions can, in large amount, be toxic to dogs.
So my Salisbury steak, I just have to limit it to a hamburger?
Yeah, you might want to do that. It's a weird thing. Onions can cause a particular type of anemia in dogs. Other common things, unripe tomatoes can be a problem if eaten in large amount, particularly if they're still on the vine and not red yet. So it's a weird list of things. And as a result, it's frustrating for people because it's hard to keep track of all of them at the same time. Yeah. But raisins and grapes are high on the list. Yeah.
Ice cream doesn't,
ice cream is
lactose a problem? Because I've seen, ice cream for dogs. I mean, yeah. I've seen that in some specialty stores.
Yeah, I mean, dogs' digestive systems, I mean, they're predominantly carnivorous. They're to some extent omnivorous. They're opportunistic eaters. They'll eat grains and plants.
They like good smelling grass.
They like all sorts of things. Ice cream is one of those things. While they're not, you know, to some extent they're lactose intolerant. If you went wild with the ice cream, it'd be a problem. But if they take a lick of it, it's not a big deal.
I have a friend whose dogs likes goose poop.
Yeah, that's a delicacy among the dogs.
Is it? It's like foie gras for dogs.
Poop in general is a delicacy for dogs. Some of them like their own. Some of them like the neighbor's pets. Goose, deer, you name it, they'll
eat
it.
What is it about that?
I really don't know, except to say that dogs are disgusting. And you know, they're. It's those things can certainly carry parasites and things as well. So it's an additional health issue other than just being disgusting.
Do cats have similar flavor intolerance?
They're pickier than dogs. They're not as apt to eat everything they find. But I've certainly seen cats that will eat anything you put in front of them.
Are there things on the no-no checklist for cats?
I know we already talked about aspirin and Tylenol earlier. But as far as foods, the list is relatively similar. I think we see these problems less often in cats just because they are honestly less prone to eat large amounts of stupid things as dogs are. You know, dogs, if they get into the bag of something, they'll eat the entire thing. Whereas cats are usually a little bit more measured in what they'll consume. So those problems pop up less often.
Follow up with your question. Georgetown Veterinary Clinic veterinarian Mike Feetz here in the studio today. 979-0919, 1-877-WNRN rocks. Sarah from Levinson asked about neutering. What can you tell us about the overabundance of cats and dogs in our current nation?
It's a huge problem. It's a particular problem for cats just because they're so capable of surviving on their own. I mean, they've very successfully made the transition as wild animals when they want to be, and they can survive very well. Dogs are a little bit more dependent, but still do plenty of breeding on their own. But it is, one walk through any animal shelter in the area, and it's hard not to be struck by the enormity of the problem. It's just a shame. I mean, these animals are homeless, and I think the focus should be on adopting the pre-existing animals rather than creating new ones.
Charlottesville Albemarle has a wonderful shelter.
Yeah.
But I always want to remind people, Lazarus came from the Nelson County Adopt a Home shelter, as did Zephyr, et cetera, and others that you've heard me talk about. If you live on the south side of Albemarle, take a drive south towards the Nelson County spot. All animals need a home, but don't forget that you have one a little closer than driving up north. All right, we got a call from Scott here in Charlottesville. Hey, Scott.
Hey, how are you?
I'm doing well. What you got for us?
Two things, one brief. Both brief, how about that? One is a reminder that people are always welcome to, they have, particularly after hours, they're welcome to call the Poison Center if they have questions about animals. We do handle calls. If it gets beyond our expertise, we'll refer people along to, there is a vet ox hotline that charges a consult fee, but they're pretty good too. But usually it's a matter of they will also consult with your local vet about more advanced issues or treatments. Number two, we have a dog that is fairly old. We have two dogs, and one of them probably will have to put to sleep in the next 2-3 months. Have you observed, do you think it's helpful for the surviving dog to have some role or interaction, or what are your thoughts on sort of how to handle that? Bring the dog in after the one has been put to sleep and so forth?
I get that question a lot, and I think to some extent there's some projecting going on there. I'm not entirely sure that animals process it the way we do. It may vary animal to animal. I don't have a blanket recommendation for that. I think in most cases, we end up doing whatever is most comforting for the owner. I don't particularly think they need to see it or even that they're capable of understanding it. That said, I don't think it's harmful in most cases. I don't think they quite recognize the extent of what's just happened. I think they are very smart, however, and they do know something's wrong. And there's no question that after one pet is lost, the remaining animals in the household respond to the fact that something's changed. Insofar as a member of their family is suddenly absent, they know something's wrong, and it can upset them. Their routine changes. A lot of things change. Whether introducing them to the body of the one you just lost changes any of that, I'm not so sure. But it is a difficult thing, and the remaining pets in the house definitely do respond. And just touching back on the poison issue, I do generally direct people to call SPCA Poison Control. There is a charge, but they'll set up a reference number. And once in a while, there are peculiarity, just differences between humans and animals, where those differences kind of come to bear and become significant. But both are very good resources. Yeah.
11:19 here on the Wake Up Call. Markets of Tiger Fuel forecast for Central Virginia and the Shenandoah Valley. Mostly sunny today. Highs in the mid-60s. Mostly cloudy tonight. Lows in the mid-40s. Mostly cloudy with rain tomorrow. Highs 52 to 57 right now. It's a pretty nice day outside. 60 in the Valley, 62 in Lynchburg, 62 in Richmond, and 62 in Charlottesville.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call, brought to you by The Hook and by the Markets of Tiger Fuel, a refreshing pause on your journey to anywhere with locations all over town. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
And let's give a shout out to Blue Ridge Graphics for allowing us to be here today. You can find them at Mead Avenue and East High Street. serving Charlottesville with custom t-shirts, sportswear, and professional graphic design since 1979. That's Blue Ridge Graphics, 296-9746, and online at brgtshirts.com. All right, we're back here with Dr. Mike Beetz from the Georgetown Veterinary Clinic. Follow up with your question about your pet, Dr. Beetz will do his magic right here in the studio. Mike, here's a question that a friend of mine gave me to bring in. It's a male dog, has stayed at a friend's house multiple times, stayed there with no problems for several trips, and since then, several times when left alone with the other animals, has peed inside. In the same space, I think, twice, I think, if I remember the story correctly. So, stayed there several times with no problem, left alone with the other pets with no problem, and then a couple times recently, again, left with no problem, peed in the same spot twice.
And this is only when he's left with at the other house?
Yes.
Okay. When it's that situational, it's usually behavioral. I always recommend in those cases ruling out the usual things. I mean, anytime a dog is urinating in a strange spot and that's uncommon for them, you worry about urinary tract infections, things like crystals and stones in the urine that can cause discomfort. In this case, it seems very targeted. I would certainly still rule those things out and make sure that's not what's going on. But my suspicion is you'll find this one's behavioral. Whether it's territorial or not, it's hard to say. When behavioral urinary problems are that targeted, you do want to make sure there's not something underlying it, some other illness or stress. But often the best thing to do is just avoid the target situation. I think frequently animals will decide that a particular location is good to urinate on. And then once that's set in their head, it can be very difficult to reverse that tendency. But you do want to rule out underlying disease. I mean, a lot of times, even if it is behavioral, the animal may have even non-urinary illness underlying things that's causing some kind of stress or discomfort and resulting in the weird behavioral circumstances. In a lot of these cases, they do boil down to avoidance. I had to I went through this with my own cat. So even veterinarians have to deal with these things. Decided my bed was an appropriate litter box. It was solved for a couple of years by just keeping her out of the bedroom. It just gets difficult to shut the door all the time. Eventually I trained her. I've passed this on to a few clients now. Most of them just laugh. I don't know how many people actually go and do this. I ended up training her to just stay off the bed, and I did it by, it's absurd, building a queen-size blanket out of masking tape and laying it over the bed, sticky side up. And after about 2 weeks of that, she learned every time she jumped on the bed, her feet would stick to the blanket, and it was unpleasant enough that she stopped jumping in the bed. So I no longer sleep under masking tape, but she does not go on the bed anymore.
Oh, man.
Yeah, so sometimes, getting them away from those locations is about all you can do.
979-0919. Call about your sticky side tape blanket or other, maybe you've already solved your problem by yourself with the help of other long-term pet-owning friends with your own vet.
Yeah, I'm always curious to hear what solutions other people come up with.
979-0919, 1-877-WNRN rocks on this beautiful Sunday morning here in Charlottesville. Dr. Mike Beetz from the Georgetown Veterinary Clinic asked questions to Mike. Hey, I found a tick on Lazarus just the other day.
Yeah.
Not a long-term dog owner, ticks in the cold weather months, really? Yeah.
Well, I mean, you just gave the weather forecast. It's 62 degrees. But we'd see them even last year. We were seeing them in January, February, not a lot of them, but now and then we'd still get tick bites in. So even outside of tick season, you'll see them, just not as predominantly as before, but it's been warm this year. So we're still seeing a pretty good number of them.
I see one call coming in now. So the 979-0919 number, but the toll free line is still open, 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS. Is there, what is the difference, if there is one, between the two types or multiple of pest control? I know that there's Frontline, which is one I use, and the, I guess, the heartworm. I use Interceptor, but I know that there are others out there. Is there a difference, or is it just competing, the Coke and Pepsi?
It's not quite Coke and Pepsi. I mean, there are differences. You know, some are better for some situations than others. You know, a lot of them as baseline preventatives work very well. And then there's subtle little differences between them that might make us choose one versus another in a case. But when used for preventative purposes, they're reasonably similar. You know, the difference between Interceptor, say, and HeartGuard is bigger than the difference between Coke and Pepsi. They're very different drugs that work in very different ways. At the level of the end user, they're fairly similar in what they do and what they accomplish. Yeah.
How do I know which one to use? I mean, is this something that I ask my vet because you have, you know, that's one of your specialties, or is this something where I need to read about it online or in the magazine and then go, that's what I want to be my end result?
Sure. I think a dose of both is fine. I certainly recommend talking to your vet. In the end, the decision is fairly tailored to that dog. I mean, and honestly, sometimes it's as strange as just the dog prefers to eat this tablet. So
my dog eats anything. Yeah. So I don't even have to crumble it up. I just put it on top and it's gone.
Yeah. The flea and tick preventatives are more complex. I see more variability in the function between those, but it's a non-predictable sort of variability. I haven't found that one is exceedingly better than the others. So, you know, I'm not going to make any claim that one is better. In individual circumstances, we'll often find that one works better.
We got Gina from Richmond. Hey, Gina.
Hi.
Morning.
Sorry, my garage door's shutting. Sorry. I was going to get my dogs outside. Hi, I have a question about my male dog. He's about 6.5 years old. Uh-huh. And about a year ago, he started getting kind of large, soft tissue lumps, which I took him into the vet and, you know, just kind of told me to keep an eye on it. Sometimes older dogs get those, I guess they're like fatty tissue or something.
Yep.
In the last month or two, he's been getting hard nodules, kind of like harder lumps on his chest area.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was wondering if it's something that just comes with age or how often I should have them checked.
Yeah, in most cases, the simple answer is yes, they come with age, but I do recommend having them checked. The majority of these wind up being nothing more than cosmetic. The most common type and most likely what you're describing are lipomas, which are... They're technically tumors, but they're benign, so we try to avoid the word because it's scarier than it should be.
Great. So I should definitely probably just take them in again. And
it's worth getting them checked. The harder ones may not be. I see lipomas that can be very firm and don't necessarily, you know, feel like lipomas. Most of these things can't really be diagnosed from feeling them, though. And I usually recommend having each lump in turn aspirated, which is not quite the same as a biopsy. It's just using a needle to suck out some cells and take a look at it under the microscope. Most vets should be able to do that. You have a fairly good answer as to what these are. Obviously, as dogs grow more and more of these, it starts to get harder and harder to keep track. I mean, some dogs, we maintain, you know, kind of diagrammed lump charts on these dogs. I mean, these poor things have 30 growths at various places on their body. The reason I think it's worth getting checked is once in a while you'll have a growth that actually should be removed sneak in under the radar. And if you're just assuming they're all benign, you might get burned. Dogs are common to things like mast cell tumors in their skin, which should be excised. But by and large, don't lose sleep over it. I'd say get them checked out. And if something needs to be done, it will. But most of these do wind up just being benign changes with old age. Yeah.
All right. Mm-hmm. Thanks, Gina. Phone line's now open for your question. Your call, 979-0919. Dial us up here at WNRN, 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS. Dr. Mike Feetz here as ask your questions about your pet. Mike from the Georgetown Veterinary Clinic here in Charlottesville. Mike, are you required to report any pet abuse that you see? I mean, if you take your kid to the pediatric doctor, that's I don't know if that's a state law or just an ADA sort of thing,
right?
Or whatever.
I don't know at what level that law is, but it does not carry over into veterinary medicine.
Is that a clinic rule that you handle?
No, it's not a clinic rule at all. One of the corollaries that comes with mandatory reporting laws is that the doctors who report those things are protected from any kind of legal action, countersuing, that kind of thing. Since we're not mandatory reporters, it puts us in a bind if something is reported on and isn't, if someone isn't actually prosecuted or found guilty on that count, it leaves you legally liable. So it is frustrating, in a lot of cases, it could be very difficult to get involved in those cases. Yeah.
All right. We got Larry from Charlottesville. Hey, Larry.
Hey, how you doing?
Having a good day so far. What are you bringing?
Yeah, same here. I just wonder, what is the proper way of removing a tick?
I'm glad you asked that. Ticks have kind of, I don't know if it's just popular culture or what, have been granted supernatural powers by a lot of people. They need to be suffocated, burned, all these things like vampires. Generally, honestly, you just grab them close to the skin and pluck them off. You can get some tweezers or get a pair of hemostats or forceps or something. Just get close to the skin, as close as you can. Grab it tight and yank it off. There's often a lot of concern about leaving part of the tick. It's nearly impossible not to. They literally, when they bite, they secrete in their saliva something that pretty literally glues them into the dog. So chances are something will be left behind, but that'll get pushed out over the course of a few days. It's like having a splinter. Your body will expel that. Unless you leave a huge chunk of tick behind, even then, the worst that's going to happen is you might get a local infection that might need treatment. But in general, it's not something you need to run to the vet for if there's a tick. Usually you just grab it close to the skin and yank it off.
What do I do with it after I take it? I mean, I've seen people who burn them with a match, who put them in between pieces of scotch tape. You can't flush it down the toilet because it'll live even through your, through the sewer system.
Yeah, squish it, do what you need to do with it, just chuck it out. I mean, it's not, they don't need to be handled in any kind of mystical, magical way. They're just bugs. Yeah.
All right, 11:32 on the wake-up call. A phone line is open, 979-0919. 1-877-WNRN rocks. Mike Feetz here, answering questions about pets. Pet insurance. Mm-hmm. We talked briefly early on about the cost of medications, et cetera. And I know that pet insurance exists. Mm-hmm. What's sort of some guidelines as to whether or not to get it?
Sure. It's tough. I mean, you don't know. It's one of those things you don't realize you need until you need it. I have a fairly small percentage of clients that are using it. Most who have it seem to appreciate it. And it's like a lot of things with insurance. To the average person, honestly, it'll probably wind up costing you more per year. But what it does is it allows you to spend that money slowly, so it doesn't come as a huge, wallet busting thing all at once. And then if a tragedy does happen, your dog's running in the yard and snaps his ACL or something, you're covered. So I think a lot of people do like having it. I mean, in some ways it mimics a forced savings plan. It's requiring you to put money away so that you don't have to deal with unexpected things. It has its uses. I have some clients who really like it. A lot of people make do without it. I don't consider it indispensable, but it's something I think people should think about, especially if they're, particularly into budgeting and trying to keep everything.
Pets, like certain breeds of dog or cat, where you might say, well, look, you're more likely to spend money. My Lazarus just lounges all day, but someone else.
As a general rule, and there's clearly exceptions to this, larger breed dogs wind up costing more. They're in general more prone to a lot of things, including things like physical trauma. I mean, one of the most expensive common things people have to deal with are orthopedic injuries, broken legs, snapped ligaments, those things where you've got an otherwise healthy dog, and clearly you're going to go ahead and treat it, but there's no inexpensive way of doing it. Plus, larger breed dogs, just by virtue of being larger, take much larger amounts of medication. So a lot of times a simple course of antibiotic in a little terrier costs 10 times less than in the Great Dane that comes strolling through the door.
Do you have a potential yearly cost for a dog or a cat?
Nothing I've worked out in advance. I could probably always figure that out, but I've never actually stopped and done it.
Cats cost less than dogs? Because that wet cat food is gross and expensive. But I would think that you might take the dog to the vet more often.
And we don't typically recommend wet cat food. Dogs probably do come in more often, but that's often owner choice rather than recommendation. We do recommend cats come in annually. I mean, they're prone to things like heart disease and so on that won't be detected unless someone hears a murmur or something along those lines. In general, costs are probably relatively close. I'd say cats might be a little bit lesser, but in general, healthier. They don't, you know, there's a lot of cats kind of lounge around, especially indoor cats that aren't prone to, you know, getting hit by cars or mauled by the neighbor's dog. Don't come in as frequently, I think.
Yeah. Let's see. We got a call from Vicky in Richmond, but the local number is open. 979-0919 is open. And hi, Vicky.
Hi.
Morning.
Good morning. Question for Mike?
I do. I have two questions. The first question is, I've been giving my dog Advantage for years, and it's worked terrifically.
Sure.
And now it is not. I'm not finding any fleas. However, they scratch shortly after their application.
Okay. Are they scratching where you applied it, or just in general?
Pardon?
Are they scratching where you're applying the Advantage, or just in general?
Just in general.
Just in general.
They shouldn't be scratching at all.
Yeah, and how recently is this?
It's been for months. Finally connected that the medication's just not working.
Yeah, I mean, it's possible. I mean, if you're not seeing fleas, maybe fleas have nothing to do with it. I mean, dogs are very prone to various sorts of allergies, fleas being the most common. But any number of environmental and dietary allergies can happen in dogs. If you wanted to experiment, and it's not to knock Advantage as a product at all, it's a great flea preventative. You might want to just try a different one and see if you have better luck with that. If you're still seeing similar things, it's going to make me think it's not a flea related issue. There have been a lot of unsubstantiated thoughts about flea resistance to these medications. It keeps coming up kind of anecdotally, in local towns, people feel like it's not working anymore. And every time it's subject to any kind of real study, it seems to be that that's not what's going on. But in these cases, I don't think there's anything wrong with switching to a different one and seeing if you have better luck with it. If you're still having itching problems, it's going to leave me wondering that there isn't something more going on, some other kind of allergy at the root of it. Because especially if you're not seeing fleas or evidence of fleas, that may not be at all what's happening.
All right, Vicky, do you have a second question?
I do.
Yeah.
I think this started when my little dog was traumatized by someone, a neighbor. And now she's breathing heavily, excessively, and she's licking excessively.
Okay.
And her behavior is very afraid to go out during the day. At night, of course, none of the neighbors are out. She'll go out just fine and dandy.
Sure. That's interesting. And how old is she?
She's about five.
It may be a response to some kind of stress. And certainly if she had an unpleasant experience, luck to go there. Situations like that are generally managed through reconditioning, you know, trying to take them to that location and gradually accustom them to being in that spot without fear, trying to associate happy things with those locations. You described the panting and so on, and that, I don't know if you're seeing it all the time or not, or if just, you know, under those specific circumstances.
It's all the time.
It is all the time?
Yes.
If you're seeing things like that, it might be worth getting her checked out anyway. Things like panting can be due to other underlying problems other than stress, and it might be there's two things going on or we're making false connections, but panting can be seen with obviously, you know, heart, lung problems, if they're having any trouble moving air at all. Otherwise, disorders like Cushing's disease, which also can result in stress in a lot of dogs. It's a hormonal problem. It might be worth, you know, looking into things like that. So I think certainly it sounds like a stress problem, but the underlying reason for that stress might be a little bit more complicated than it is at the surface.
It's becoming very complicated.
Yeah.
I have taken her to several vets.
Uh-huh. And I guess then from your frustration, nothing's been determined.
No.
Yeah. I mean, assuming the kind of requisite diagnostics have been done, you know, basic screens for things like Cushing's disease and those sorts of things. I mean, if it does start to seem like it is just a behavioral problem, you know, other than conditioning, you know, as a last resort in some dogs, and I always want to emphasize this isn't ever intended to be a magic bullet for anything. We do occasionally use behavior-modifying medications in dogs. I mean, things that are basically antidepressants. I don't like doing it offhand, or at least not until other avenues have been explored. But it can be a useful adjunct to training in these cases and trying to recondition them to be okay in those environments. The hope is always we're only using those things temporarily in order to recondition the dog and then hopefully take them off of it again. You know, consigning a dog to a lifetime of being on antidepressants is you know, I consider it a very last resort. But there are certainly cases where doing that is the only way to bring any kind of quality of life back to these animals, even if you're only doing it temporarily. And I don't know if that's something that you've explored at all. Or
Yes, I've been giving them a triptyline, and I just couldn't give it to her. I just feel like there's got to be another avenue before I start something that drastic.
Sure, and I think that's the proper way of going about it is to, you know, explore it as a behavioral problem first, see if you can do that, and then use these medications as a last resort adjunct once you're confident of what's going on. You know, those drugs work well in a lot of cases, but I'm not a fan of just throwing them around every time I'm frustrated with a case. Yeah.
All right, Vicki. Well, best of luck. Hope things work out for you and your dog.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
All right, 11:41 here on the Wake Up Call. Georgetown veterinary doctor Mike Feetz here in the studio. Dial up with your question, 979-0919, 1-877 WNRN Rocks.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call, brought to you by the Markets of Tiger Fuel and by The Hook, an innovative weekly on newsstands every Thursday. Now here's Rick with what you can find in this week's Hook.
Oh, this week the Landmark Hotel is just an unfinished structure on the downtown mall. Is mogul Halsey Miner going to finish the project or spend his time working on the ever-growing list of litigation surrounding it? One apartment complex has some unusually high water bills. With $200-plus charges, are the tenants using too much water or just helping the company make a larger profit? And what does a restaurant's small dollop of ice cream tell you? Well, The Hook explains. The Hook, share the love. And thanks to Blue Ridge Mountain Sports for being with us today. If it's keeping you warm and having fun in the outdoors this winter, Blue Ridge has the gear for you. Whether your outdoor adventure is winter running, hiking, climbing, or snowshoeing, you'll find Blue Ridge Mountain Sports in the Barracks Road Shopping Center offering all the goodies. You can find them at the Mountain Inn at Wintergreen or online, brms.com. And not that you would, but don't go anywhere, because in 18 minutes or so, Drew Thompson will be here for Les Temps Perdue. If French isn't your thing here at NRN, that means The Time's Gone By, which is 80s and 90s alternative music. Tune in for it next at noon. Les Temps Perdue, brought to you in part by Plan 9 Music. All right, 11:42 on the wake-up call. The phone lines are ringing for Dr. Mike Feetz. 979-0919, 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS. All right, I got two people online, so let's see. Christy, don't go anywhere. You called in second. First is Rick from...
Good morning.
Clark County. Hey, Rick.
Morning. I just had a question about training. I am adopting a rescue Australian Shepherd, and I'm picking up later this week. And he was an outside dog, evidently, that was turned into a shelter, and he will need to be housebroken.
Sure.
And I just wondered if you have, and I've never housebroken an adult male dog before, and I just wondered if you had any recommendations or observations.
Yeah, you know, obviously there's a little bit of working with that individual dog, but I mean, in general, we recommend crate training.
You said crate?
Crate, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, crate training is it's commonly misunderstood as well. A lot of people expect that the crate is a punishment, and when the dog has an accident, you banish them to their crate. The goal of crate training is largely, you know, dogs is in general won't urinate where they sleep. As a result, if they're in a crate, they're less likely to have accidents when you're not there. And then when you are around, should they have an accident while you're there, you can correct them, bring them outside. But it allows you to focus more on the positive end of training than anything else. You know, taking them for walks, praising them when they do go outside, try and associate the proper behavior with a reward or benefit. Most dogs train okay. In this case, it's an adult. Depending what he knows, you may find that you're backtracking a little bit. It does get difficult. You know, some dogs take better to crate training than not. Some don't seem to have the instinct not to go where they sleep. And in those cases, crate training it doesn't work because you're missing the main benefit of it in those cases. And in those cases, you're still typically best off focusing on the positive end of things. You're just trying to minimize how often the dog has a chance to have an accident without you there to say something about it. Otherwise, I'm not a fan at all of the alpha dog techniques that are getting really common, pinning your dog to the ground, growling at them. It's a good way to end up with a fear dog, particularly with the breed that you're looking at. They're a great breed. I see a lot of great Aussies, but they certainly can be a little bit neurotic as a collective group. I wouldn't challenge them in that way.
Okay. Yeah. Great. Well, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Mike, just a quick follow-up to that. Do you mm-hmm. buy the crate? Can you rent it from your local shelter? I mean, what do you do?
I imagine you'll end up buying one. I'm not sure anywhere rents them. And in most cases, you end up having it in the long haul. A lot of dogs use it as just their bed and their kind of go-to spot to be. I mean, that, which kind of underscores the idea. It's not meant to be a punishment. It's sort of their home base. And a lot of dogs continue to use those as beds throughout their life. What people run into some trouble with are the larger breed dogs that are a very different size as adults than they were as puppies. And you feel like you're constantly replacing crates because the dog is getting bigger. In those cases, what you're often best off doing is getting a crate that's big enough to accommodate them once they're bigger, and, you know, walling off half of it with boxes or something to effectively make it smaller when they're younger.
All right. Thanks, Rick. Next up, we got Christy from Harrisonburg. Hi, Christy.
Hi.
What's your question?
I have a 6-year-old Pomeranian, and he's mostly housebroken, but he seems to have problems randomly. Like, he'll just make a mess on the carpet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if we've been around him maybe all day, go out for an hour, he'll choose that time to make a mess.
Right.
Then we take him out every hour or two because he's so bad about it.
Right.
And he'll into patterns where for months he'll go and not make a mess,
uh-huh.
and then if he does it once, it's like he lapses into this routine where he does it all the time
sure.
for months until he gets into a better pattern.
That's interesting.
And I'm gonna
is he urinating or is he defecating? What's
what we should do?
What
is he peeing or pooping?
He does both.
I could ask it that way too. I mean, if it's both, it's more likely to be a behavioral thing, which is frustrating. And you may find, even though he's an adult dog, that crating him when you leave is the best way to handle something like this, so he's not having those accidents. There's nothing wrong with going back to crate training in an adult animal, even though typically they're beyond that point. And that's typically what I would recommend at a point like this. You know, if it were just urinary, I might more strongly consider things like urinary tract infections. If it was just that he was pooping inside, we might look at, parasites, things like that. It may be worth looking into those things anyway. I've had dogs that have one problem and it seems to bleed over into the other. So I wouldn't assume it's not a medical problem, but again, it sounds likely behavioral. Why he goes into a run of it is harder to say. And that's one of the reasons I think I'd look into things like, you know, urinary tract disease, drop off a stool sample at your vet. Make sure there are no parasites underlying things. Because if it's something like that, it may be a very easily solvable issue. But otherwise, you may be back to the drawing board on crate training for a little while.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I think it has to do with, he seems to have kind of emotional issues, if that's possible for dogs.
Like,
if he gets upset.
Uh-huh.
Or he acts like his feelings are hurt. He goes and
yeah. I mean, dogs will definitely, especially if they're stressed out by anything, they'll manifest those sorts of things. A lot of owners read it as spite, which I don't think it is. If they're stressed out, they'll be prone to those sorts of problems. If there is a particular stress that you've identified in his life or anything like that, you know, trying to minimize that might help to some extent. And those stresses can be. You know, there's construction next door, you've got a new dog, there's a new friend that's visiting all the time, new relationships, things like that. You'll see animals respond to those things. I don't think it's malicious or vindictive or spiteful. I think it's just they're stressed out and that's how they show it. But if you can identify that stress and minimize it, that's great. Otherwise, I think you're kind of left with the kind of tried and true crate training sorts of things. Yep.
All right.
Okay.
Good luck, Christy. Thanks.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
You know, it only took me about a year and a half, but I finally got a routine where Lazarus doesn't have accidents in the house very frequently. You know,
it's an exciting day.
Yes, it was, believe me. And for those of you who are gone for your house is empty for major parts, we get up in the morning and we eat immediately. And then by the time that I'm done showering and getting ready for work. There's enough. It's been 45 minutes to an hour. We go outside, and then he's ready to go.
There you go. You give him the final push.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And then when I come home, rarely is there an accident anymore. It's a wonderful, wonderful dog. Thank you so much, Lazarus, for filling into that. Dr. Mike Feetz here from the Georgetown Veterinary Clinic. Call up, ask your question, 979-0919, 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS. And we have Margaret from Madison. Hi, Margaret.
Yeah, good morning.
Good morning. Question?
I have a one-year-old male Jack Russell who's still intact, and he's really good about bathroom, you know, going out and doing his thing. But he will, when I visit someone and I take him, he thinks that their furniture is part of his area to mark, and it's kind of embarrassing.
Yeah.
It's really embarrassing.
Sure. Sure. Yeah, we have a theme this morning, Rick. And certainly being an intact male, it's not unusual to see that sort of marking behavior. I mean, that's a territory thing. You'll see it more at other people's houses because that's territory he has yet to claim. It's always recommended in cases like that these animals be neutered. Once they're a year old, you might reach a point of diminishing returns, though. A lot of things that start as a hormonal problem eventually become a behavioral one. So even with the hormonal end of it removed, this may be something he's used to at this point. That said, he's fairly young, and you may get more mileage out of that than you would if he's got another year or two under his belt. So I would certainly look at doing that. And then otherwise, you know, this is a purely behavioral thing. And in a lot of those cases, you know, if that's not doing the trick, avoidance is really your best bet. I mean, at that point, it sounds silly to say, but bringing him to visit the neighbors just might not be the best idea. Yeah.
All right, Margaret.
Okay.
Thanks for the call.
All right, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
All right, 11:52 here in the wake-up call. 6, 7, 8 minutes left to make your call in. Dr. Mike Feetz here answering free vet questions.
All about pee and poop.
Pee and poop. free until, of course, the spring fundraiser of 2010. 979-0919. Mike, should you wash your dog more than once a month or any regular time frame?
There's no magic amount. Some dogs, if you overbathe them, will, you know, get dry and itchy and that sort of thing. I usually tell people, to one extent, just wash your dog as much as you feel comfortable with. Some people are very sensitive to dog smell and that kind of thing and just need to bathe them more frequently. And certainly if they're dirty, don't hesitate to give them a bath. And if they just rolled in mud, it's silly not to just because they had a bath last week. So long as the dog isn't showing any adverse effects from it, you could sort of bathe your dog as often as you like. But most, if you start getting too frequent, they'll end up with some dry skin.
Lazarus smells like Fritos, so that's surely a
Fritos.
When it's time for a bath, he has that smell of Fritos.
Frito smell. Yes, that's a new one.
That's usually the sign that it's time for a bath.
To research that one.
I'll bring him to see you next
good.
Time
that
the smell comes around, right? We can do a little.
We'll name the condition after
yes,
you.
Yes, I like that. Judy, are you there?
Yes, I'm
Judy
here.
Judy from Charlottesville, fire away with your question.
I have a beagle mix. She's about 6 years old, and she started snoring.
Snoring.
Really
yeah.
loudly.
Uh-huh.
And it's really annoying.
Yeah, snoring isn't. Snoring is annoying.
No, it's not.
I know.
I stand up for those of us who snore.
I'm among you. So, snoring is similar to what it is in people, and there's no great way of stopping it. I mean, you know, if there's a number one contributor, it's probably weight. I don't know if your beagle is tipping the scales or not. If the dog is overweight, you know, getting the weight off may help a little bit. Sometimes you'll just
right. Pretty good weight, yeah. I mean, for her.
Yeah, and then otherwise, you know, it can be associated with other things. You know, if you're not seeing sneezing, coughing, evidence of any kind of upper respiratory problem, then, you know, you tend to assume there's no infection going on. But, you know, if a dog has any kind of anything going on with their sinuses at all, be it infectious, allergic, you know, it can cause swelling of those tissues and promote snoring. Has this been a long-term thing, or is this just recent?
It's been about a year.
Yeah.
She does do that. Reverse sneezing.
Sure,
that's what our vet calls it. Anyway,
and it gets tough because a lot of these things are things I don't often see the dog in the action of doing.
Yeah,
people come in and they're trying their best to make these noises and show me what the animal's doing. What I've occasionally recommended, actually, is if you have a digital camera that gets movies, you can always film them in the process of doing it.
Oh.
I've had some cases where that's helped me a lot. People will bring in a quick movie clip of their dog doing what they've been trying to explain to me for 3 years.
And
then suddenly all is clear. In the absence of evidence of a respiratory infection, you know, discharge from the nose, things like that, you may just have a dog that snores. If you see coughing, things like that, there's other obscure problems, things like laryngeal paralysis and so on, that you may end up working up if symptoms dictate. It's tough in a lot of these cases where all you've got is snoring to justify an expensive workup for a problem that's probably not there.
It seems to get worse with allergy season, when we're experiencing allergies.
Sure.
Snoring gets worse.
Sure, and that may make some sense. You know, sometimes you'll see these things worsen, you know, is the heat on in the house, things like that, anything that can cause those sinus tissues to swell.
Right.
You know, allergies in dogs tend to be of the itchy skin type. But once in a while, you'll get respiratory issues in dogs with allergies. And it's tough because they're frequently diagnosed presumptively. There's not a lot of way offhand to separate that from the infectious problems that dogs can have as well. But if it's going on this long and you haven't seen it spiral into something more serious, and it sounds to me like, it's silly to say, but it sounds to me like you've just got a dog that snores.
We just banish her to another room.
Yeah, you're going
to
have to get a white noise machine or something. Yeah.
All right, thanks, Judy.
Thank you.
Yep.
All right, 11:56 here on the wake-up call. Mike, just a few minutes left. Let me do this real quick.
Mm-hmm.
You are listening to WNRN Charlottesville and WNRS FM Sweetbriar Amherst Lynchburg. And we want to thank Ananda, the Charlottesville Community Center for Conscious Living and Alternative Healing Practices. They have a focus on mind-body integration and soul-level living. They offer massage, energy revitalization, and stress relief. Ananda, off the downtown mall next to Vinegar Hill Theater. For more information, it's AnandaWellnessCenter.com. All right, I got one person online. I got two questions that came in internet, so try and do this real quick. Can my dog get the swine flu from my daughter?
No, that's the short answer. The longer answer is, I guess it's debatable whether your daughter has swine flu. That virus is, as for now at least, restricted to people. Dogs do have their own flu virus. Everyone's hearing about H1N1, the swine flu. Dogs have H3N8, which is the canine influenza virus, which came from horses a few years ago and is now sticking around in dogs. So that's out there now, but there's no danger of that going to or from your family members. Yep.
Let's take this call from Sheila in Palmyra. Hi, Sheila.
Hi, how are you today?
It's a good day. You got a question for Mike?
Yes, I do. I own 3 Jack Russell dogs,
uh-huh.
And as you know, they're very hyper. They are both inside and outside dogs, so they're, you know, get into a lot of stuff outside.
Sure.
They have terrible, terrible bad breath, and I've tried everything, and I cannot change it.
But breath is tough in dogs, and I don't know how old they are or their dental condition in general. I mean, certainly breath is, to some extent, associated with dental disease in dogs, and if that's there, not so much for breath reasons, but for health reasons, I'd get it addressed. But even doing that, I mean, dog can have the most immaculate teeth in the world and still have fairly bad breath by virtue of the things they eat and do. There's not, if it's just breath and not, you know, a health problem otherwise, there's not necessarily a great solution. I mean, certain chew toys and things like that may help to an extent to calm it down. The breath itself, so insofar as it's not a reflection of dental disease or other underlying disease, is a lot of times just bad dog breath.
When I've taken them to the vet, they've looked at them and said that they don't look bad, and they've even recommended that Virbac Animal Health Dental Toothpaste.
Yep.
And they don't like it when I try to rub it on the gums, so it's kind of a fight or a battle.
Which is unfortunate, because that's the part that really matters is the gum line. That's where the disease builds up and becomes an issue. It's unfortunate. In an ideal world, we'd all be able to brush our animals' teeth, but reality is it's not as possible as we'd like in a lot of cases either, because the dog resists it or people don't feel they have the time, especially when you've got 3 dogs, obviously it becomes a little bit more. But you know, the usual recommendation is to brush their teeth at least every day to every other day, and that's usually the point that makes most people balk on it. You know, people with the best intentions will brush their dog's teeth every week or so is what I usually hear from people, and it you know, while the intentions are good, it misses the point. That gives too much time for disease to build up between brushings, and certainly that'll contribute to bad breath. But I have dogs go home from their full dental scaling, and by the next day their breath is pretty nasty.
Yeah. All right, thanks for the call, Sheila.
Thank you. Have a great day.
You're welcome.
All right, Dr. Mike Feetz here from the Georgetown Veterinary Clinic, and the hour's already up.
How can it be?
I don't know, but thanks for coming in, obviously we need to have you back on again soon.
Sounds good.
Last time, it's now been like 15 months. We'll have to do it faster than
that. Yeah, we'll go to 13 months and wind down.
Thank you so much. Be here next week. We'll be talking about the Georgetown, George Washington papers, including the Civility Project. Go online and Google that. See you next Sunday.
This has been your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is brought to you by The Hook, an innovative weekly from the people who really know the news on Newsstands Thursday. And by Tiger Fuel, serving the Charlottesville area with home heating oil and propane, Exxon gasolines, and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the management, staff, or board of WNRN. You can contact Rick at abstractme@AOL.com or at wakeupcall@WNRN.org. The wake-up call is produced by Sean McCord. Tune in again next Sunday morning at 11 for the Wake Up Call, only on WNRN.